Hello, I'm Russell Rowland, author of 56 Counties, A Montana Journey. Welcome to 56 Counties. After Ken Robison retired as a captain after nearly 30 years of service in naval intelligence, he moved back to his home state of Montana and became a highly respected historian. Ken has published several books, with another on the way, with his primary focus being on Montana stories that have been forgotten. His new book, Lost Great Falls, explores 24 stories about the history of the town where Ken graduated from high school and where he still lives. Welcome, Ken. It's nice to see you again.
It's always great to be with you, Russell.
We're going to talk about your new book, Lost Great Falls, but before we get to that, I want to talk a little bit about your history. When did you retire from the Navy? You were a captain, right?
Yes, I retired as a Navy captain after almost 30 years in naval intelligence. I retired in 1988, a remarkable 37 years ago, but yeah. I'm not counting. And it's certainly appropriate. We're speaking on Memorial Day, that great day of remembrance for those who've sacrificed and served throughout our nation's almost 250 years. Next year will be the big 250th celebration. And if I could add, later this year, all Montanans can celebrate the opening to the public of the new Montana Heritage Center in Helena. As a trustee on the board of the Montana Historical Society, I've had the honor to help and serve during this exciting period over the past 4 years as that great Montana Heritage Center takes shape and form and is about to open in November of this year.
Yeah, that's going to be really exciting. That was a huge undertaking, and I know I toured that place years ago, and Bruce took me down to the archives, and I couldn't believe how much stuff they had that they just didn't have room to display. So,
immense collection. When you have a historical society that was formed in 1 year after we became a territory, so it was formed in 1865, you've collected a monster archive of Montana history. It's great that they've got it, and now it's going to be even greater that they'll be able to reopen the research center and also open this heritage center with a lot more room for displays and sharing history with the public. So
talk to me a little bit about you have a really strong connection to Fort Benton, and you write a lot about that place. Is that just because of it's such a fascinating place, or did you live there for a while? I can't remember.
Well, I was raised on a farm on Square Butte Bench right on the edge of Arrow Creek in southern Scioto County. And I learned to read before I entered the first grade, and from that point on, I was hooked on local history, and it was always a treat to visit Fort Benton or have a picnic at the park in Fort Benton or whatever, and to have that great history and also the Upper Missouri River right there at Fort Benton, learning about the robe and fur trade and the Native Americans, especially the Blackfoot, and all of the exciting things that, Fort Benton played in every year of Montana history, with steamboats or overland freighting or open range ranching or the great shared heritage we have with the Prairie Provinces of Western Canada. It was from the beginning I was hooked. And although I went to Great Falls High School and then on to the university and into the Navy, I kept my ties with Scioto County and Fort Benton. In fact, my sister and I still own our family farm there.
Oh, do you?
Yesterday, we were actually in Geraldine putting wreaths on graves there, as well as in Fort Benton doing the same thing. So
the main reason I wanted to interview you is because I saw you were coming out with this book called Lost Great Falls. And, you know, I have always thought that Great Falls has a really fascinating history. And I know you've long been interested in that and done a lot of writing and research about it. So tell us about this book and exactly what its focus is.
Lost Great Falls, as a lead-in, I was going to mention that since the city didn't begin to build until Montana was out of its territorial period, it was the mid-1880s when Paris Gibson started that town site of Great Falls. And, of course, we didn't have vigilantes, we didn't have steamboats, we didn't have Indian Wars. All of those were in the past. And I think because of that, Great Falls history has sort of rested on two very powerful and important laurels. One is Lewis and Clark, and the other is Charlie Russell. I mean, Charlie Russell as a nationally renowned artist, and Lewis and Clark, who share the Montana segment with so much of the rest of the nation and such an important exploration. But the rest of Montana, I mean, the rest of Great Falls history seems to have kind of lied dormant. If you go back to the shelves and try to find the very best stories on Great Falls history, you find a fairly thick volume, several hundred page volume, called Great Falls Yesterday, which was done in 1939 by the WPA. It was part of the New Deal, and it was actually printed on a mimeograph machine, so there's maybe 125 or so copies in existence. And that has kind of served as the best book with Great Falls stories. There are a number of photo books with short captions. The Tribune did a number of them. In fact, I did one called Cascade County and Great Falls, that mine is kind of a highlight of important events and people through the history around Cascade County as well as Great Falls. But the stories have to be in maybe 200 words or less with a photo. Now, that's not telling good stories. So what I've decided is, after roaming around Montana with many books covering many topics, it's time to begin to fill that neglected part of Great Falls story, and that is do the two books. The first one being Lost Great Falls, and it's a nostalgic trip through Great Falls history for those important, but in a lot of cases, kind of hidden things that that have been lost over time, not just the stories, but the building, if it's a building, or the theater has gone dark or whatever. So that's the first book. The second book is also designed to bring out Montana stories and Great Falls stories that are important to our history, but have been pretty well hidden. And it's been fun researching and discovering. And frankly, some Great Falls stories I've brought out in the past, like the Ozark Club, that story had been kind of forgotten. Another story that I'd brought out earlier and is actually in a couple of books that I've done, and that is the story of Alma Jacobs, a remarkable African-American, actually a girl that graduated from Great Falls High School, went to a segregated college in the South, and then came back to Great Falls and did powerful things like leading the community to build a new modern library, and then becoming the state librarian, and all the other things that Alma Jacobs achieved remarkably in the time of not necessarily friendly environment for achievement by African Americans. So it's time, I think, to bring out more Great Falls stories. The book Lost Great Falls will be out. It's actually just coming out now.
So talk about the main stories that your book focuses on.
Yeah, let me share a preview of the stories in the book. Deep in the heart of Blackfoot Country, the bend in the Missouri River has long served as a transportation corridor for thousands of buffalo and indigenous people from many tribes crossing a natural ford in the river above the falls, connecting Sun River Valley and the broad Judith Basin. Fueled by nearby silver and coal reserves and powered by hydroelectricity from the dams on the falls, Great Falls became a rapidly growing planned city within a decade. In little more than half a century, the electric city became Montana's largest city, undergoing dramatic growth, first from its copper refining industry that literally wired the world, and then from the homestead boom that formed the Golden Triangle that still provides huge amounts of barley and other crops. Topping off the growth, two decades later came the sudden, dramatic military growth during World War II, with two Army air bases operating, and they've continued since then throughout the Cold War. As suddenly as it grew, though, Great Falls declined dramatically during the 1970s and 80s with the loss of heavy industry and railroad repair yards. Consequently, few cities have ever fostered a greater nostalgia for their past, a yearning for the way things were once in Great Falls during those fondly recalled decades of dramatic growth. Nostalgia tends to magnify the memory of the good of the past, as Great Falls remembers those moments when it was most alive, treasuring what was then, lamenting the perceived end of those good times. And so Lost Great Falls aims to capture that romantic notion of what's been lost in time and through failed preservation, and presents an illustrative collection of important buildings no longer standing, marquees gone dark, railroads abandoned and communities vanished. And this will be a story by story through about two dozen key elements, and they can range from a remarkable dance hall that opened in the early 1900s. This was a dance hall with an unusually high ceiling, and very shortly after it opened, a couple of years, the superintendent of Fort Shaw Indian Industrial School brought his girls' basketball teams to play in Great Falls. If the weather was good, they played at Black Eagle Park on the dirt pitch out at Black Eagle Park. But if the weather wasn't good, or during the winter, most of the season, in fact, the girls would play in Luther's Hall, which was his dance hall. And it was a remarkable time because Superintendent Campbell had started basketball at Fort Shaw before the Montana high schools were very far along. In fact, Great Falls High School had not yet begun basketball in 1903, 1904, 1905. So the Fort Shaw girls would come to Great Falls, play in Luther's Hall. They'd draw a crowd of about 700 or 800, if you can imagine, jammed into that big hall, and play a brand of basketball that was just dazzling. It was absolutely amazing. The coverage by the evening newspaper, The Leader, who had especially good sports reporters, and they designed their headlines so the kids would hawk the newspapers off the streets in the evening. And so they were fascinating stories of the games at Great Falls' home team, this young bunch of girls from Fort Shaw were adopted by the Great Falls people, and they played all around Montana. In fact, for a couple of years, they not only played the high schools around Montana, but they played Missoula and Bozeman colleges. And in almost every case, they beat them. And in fact, they were so good over the couple of years that the high school sports authority determined that Fort Shaw Indian School was no longer eligible to play the high school teams. They were just too good. So there's stories like that that not only embed the story of Luther's Hall and its many lives. The last life it had, as a matter of fact, was as the Eagles Lodge for Great Falls for about 40 years. But also dynamic things that happened there, in this case, the Fort Shaw girls basketball games. Another great example is Black Eagle Park. Now, you'd think it would be over across the river on the north bank where Black Eagle was, but it wasn't. It was on the south side of the river, essentially where today's ballpark is. It's on the same ground. And Black Eagle Park opened very, very early, and it became the center of all sorts of outdoor activities, including some pretty fascinating visitors like the cavalry from Fort Assiniboine would ride overland across country to Great Falls, camp at Black Eagle Park, and the infantry, in those days, the military was segregated, so they had a black regiment of infantry at Fort Assiniboine. And so the infantry and the cavalry would both be at Black Eagle Park in camp, and then they'd go through daily routines, and they'd have special riding events, Roman chariot events, and all sorts of activities. And you can imagine how popular that was with the public. But that was the kind of events they had at Black Eagle Park. Today, if you mention Black Eagle Park, everyone automatically would think of the small park that's now north of the river in the community of Black Eagle. But for about 30 years, Great Falls had this really dynamic park on that was called Black Eagle Park. There's the stories, even though I tend to avoid both Lewis and Clark stories and Charlie Russell stories because they aren't the neglected part of Montana history.
Right, right.
Yet I found there are still neglected parts of even their stories. And in this case, there are a couple of Charlie's favorite watering holes. One was the Silver Dollar Bar, and the other was the Mint Saloon. Silver Dollar Bar with Bill Rance, a good friend of Charlie's, was on one side of the street, and the Mint Saloon with Sid Willis was on the south side of the same block on the opposite side. And the stories of those buildings, including the most exciting part to me, was going through in some detail what happened to the art, the artwork, the treasures that Charlie had in both the Silver Dollar and the Mint, and the story of why Montana wound up losing the Mint collection. That's one of the saddest stories in Great Falls and in Montana today, really, is the loss of probably more than 100 pieces of Charlie's artwork, a combination of modeling and painting and illustrated letters that wound up outside the state. And I've got detailed stories of what happened and how that all happened, and also how, unlike Bill Rance, closed when Prohibition came, he closed down the Silver Dollar, got rid of the art, and that was it. Sid Willis did just the opposite. He had a rebirth of his Mint Saloon into an actual true soft drink parlor. He made it clear from the beginning that he was not going to break the law. He was not going to serve booze under the table. He was going to have a legitimate soft drink parlor. But because of the Charlie Russell art collection that he had, and because of his talent as a greeter of people and as a very smart guy, he turned that Prohibition area Mint into a very popular spot. He'd hire an orchestra, have ladies' nights with soft drinks and so on for the kids and the ladies, and crowds would come. So his experience, in contrast to Bill Rance's, was one of great success during a time that otherwise saloons were either shut down or they were operating under the table. And many of them getting constant visits by the police. That didn't happen with the Mint, and the story is absolutely fascinating, including a story that I've got embedded in it of young George Montgomery, who George Letts in Great Falls, but became a movie star as George Montgomery, as a young man visited the Mint Saloon during Prohibition, and his host, Sid Willis, gave him an exceptional talk about where all the different pieces of Charlie Russell art came from. And of course, George Montgomery became a very accomplished artist himself. And on the levee in Fort Benton is a heroic sized statue of George Montgomery, designed and produced by George Montgomery, just as at Highland Cemetery in Great Falls is a statue of George Montgomery in cowboy garb, and that's by George Montgomery, the talented artist as well as movie star. And then, of course, there are the movie theaters, and they range from a little Alcatraz theater that happened to be in that same block as the Silver Dollar, and Charlie Russell would spend time at the Silver Dollar, and then he'd wander down the street and catch the latest Western at the Alcatraz. And there are some local historians from some years back that claim that much of his knowledge and refresher course, let's put it that way, on horses and so on came from watching Westerns, even though, of course, Charlie had ridden the plains and been a cowboy on his own, but that was years ago. And so he was watching all these Westerns at the Alcatraz Theater. They also had some of the most remarkable plush theaters. And of course, theaters generally have fallen victim to television and home entertainment in the recent decades. One of the most remarkable stories in Great Falls centered on the Pantages Theater, and it was designed and built by this young, actually he was 9 years old when he left Greece working as a waiter on French cruise ships, and made his way to the United States. And at age 12, he discovered the magic lights of San Francisco on Market Street and in the plush theaters there. And he determined that his future was going to be with vaudeville, and he was going to design and build his own theaters. And Alexander Pantages did just that. And he had a run of something like 70 Pantages theaters all along the West Coast and kind of along the northern U.S. to Minneapolis and maybe Chicago. But the only one that ever opened in Montana was that Pantages Theater in the Rocky Mountain building, which was an insurance building on Central Avenue in Great Falls. And it was a plush, remarkable building.
Wow.
The timing couldn't have been worse because it opened in 1914. And of course, you know what was happening in the mid-teens, and that is vaudeville was fading, being overrun or overpowered by motion pictures. So silent movies were becoming very popular in that same era. So after a short period, of course, the Pantages Theater turned into the Rainbow Theater, which was a very important theater in Great Falls and so on. So there's the story of that whole beginning is the Pantages and its continuation as the Rainbow and its decline. And it, as a matter of fact, is one of the most endangered buildings in Great Falls today. The Rocky Mountain building had a fire in 2009, and it has had several false starts toward reconstruction, but neither have neither of the two have succeeded, and the city commission's been very patient in waiting for the right owner to bring that building back to life. The theater was taken out sometime before. Anyway, there's story after story centered on kind of lost Great Falls stories. One of the stories that we've brought back to life, story of an antiquarian bookstore called Fireside Books. And the retired Air Force officer who changed his Air Force blues into a book host role at the Fireside Book.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time, Ken.
Well, it's always a great pleasure, and I love to share history with Montanans and with you.
You've been listening to 56 Counties here on Yellowstone Public Radio. I'm Russell Rowland, and I've been talking to Ken Robeson, author and historian who lives in Great Falls. He has just come out with a new book called Lost Great Falls, which explores much of the forgotten history of Ken's hometown. I'd like to thank Ken for a fascinating conversation, and also thanks to my son Fletcher Wayland for the transitional music, and thanks to Aaron Parrott for the theme song. Join me again on the first Monday of each month for 56 Counties.